STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello there. This is Melinda the Enforcer. I'm with Greg Kokel, and this is the STRS podcast, and I'm ready for my close-up.
We're on the movies.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah,
and you're wearing makeup. I've never seen you in the studio with makeup before.
It's because nobody ever put a camera on me before. This is why I didn't want to be on camera. Now I got to worry about what I look like at the end of a long day.
You look great. Hi there. See? We're in a movie.
Yes, we are. I'm not going to look. I'm just going to keep focused on what my job is.
Well, for all of those who asked to have Melinda included on the video, we've got it worked out now, and we're filming.
Yes, here. So
and
here we go.
You look great.
Thank you. So, you don't. Just kidding. You always look fine.
It's because You're a man.
It's
because I'm not wearing makeup. That's why.
You always look fine. You don't have to worry about it. Anyway, so this is the STRS podcast. This is our program that is short answers, short questions, short on time for people who don't have much time or a short attention span. And you send us your questions on Twitter using hashtag STRAsk. And then I pose it to Greg, and he's got 4 minutes or less to answer it. So you ready to go?
Ready.
All
ready.
Right. First question. Do we have different light or something? Because it's like I haven't got my paper together and I can see
Internet
through.
That bulb right there. Oh, there you go.
That helps.
Wow.
You're the one who turned it off.
We're all aglow now.
Oh, great.
Look at you.
Yeah, we know what light does. You can see even more. So anyways, first question. What does Jesus mean by believe in John 6, 35, 40, and 47?
Mm.
It seems like a head thing. No comments are given about what belief means.
Well, John 6, 30. Well, I got to go there.
It's in the New Testament. It's a gospel.
John, this is the Bread of Life discourse. I know that. John 6, help me out.
35, 40, and 47.
Okay. The word, I don't have Greek here, but the word believe is usually a translation of the Greek word pisteo, which means act of trust. Okay. So, I'm sorry, where does it start again? 35? Oh, well, that's a long section, the bread of life. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will not hunger, and he who believes in me will never thirst. Even as Jesus starts out here, it doesn't strike me that he's talking about some academic exercise where we're just having this belief. He's talking about satisfying hunger and satisfying thirst here. I'm pretty familiar with the rest of the passage where he talks about, in 37, all that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will certainly not cast out. So you see a parallel between believing and coming to him. For the will of my Father is this, that everyone who beholds the Son and believes in him will have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up in the last day. This is a phrase he repeats a number of times. Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me, verse 45. Again, this to me is very intimate language throughout this passage. Truly I say to you, verse 47, he who believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. I guess I don't get the impression from reading that passage that Jesus is just talking about a kind of an intellectual belief in your head. He's talking about a deep personal investment in him, a coming to him to have your needs met, your thirsts quenched, your hunger satisfied, and that this coming is only possible because of something that the Father is doing that Jesus calls the Father giving us to him that makes possible our response of belief in him. So I see intimacy all over this passage. That's one reason I like it. It's just a sweet passage, the Bread of Life discourse.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next question comes from Timothy Turner on Twitter. Are the descriptions of the seraphim in Isaiah's vision a literal physical description or symbolic and metaphorical? I don't have the passage.
Well, but, you know, it's probably the opening of Isaiah, and I can just look at it quickly. My take or my sense, because I've read this before, although it's not a book I spend a lot of time in, seraphim, I'm looking here. Rebellion of God's people, come let us reason. I'm not exactly sure where it is, but I do remember the reference to it, and as far as I could tell, it's referring to something that's real. A seraphim is a particular kind of angelic being, and I believe in angelic beings. I have no reason. Oh, here it is, chapter 6. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." So this is a powerful imagery here. On the one hand, I don't think God was sitting down and had a robe on. I think this is a visual that is given to Isaiah to communicate something about God's authority and his glory. But the thing is, when it talks about seraphim then stood above him, each having six wings, he's describing something real. In verse 6, 1, chapter 6, 1, he's talking about God sitting on his throne, lofty and exalted. He's describing something real there, even if it's metaphorical language that is part of the description, the train of his robe filling the temple. And seraphim standing above him, crying out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord," is capturing something real too. I have reason not to take the description of God in wooden literalism, like he's wearing a robe. But I have no reason not to take at face value what it says about the seraphim. So I'm inclined to take that as a description of an angelic being, which was manifest to him in this particular way, with six wings covering face, feet, and allowing him to fly.
So you can, in one passage, you can take something as literal and another as metaphorical?
Well, we do this all the time just in common language, in common conversation. You know, think of the sports page. You know, the two sports teams meet, play, and one devours the other. So you have a literal, straightforward description, and then you have a figure of speech that's built in there. I'm not exactly sure what to do with it other than that.
Well, if, you know, it was a team of cannibals, it could be literal.
The seraphim?
No. The sports teams.
No. So I just, I take this as a description of angelic beings, but angelic beings are not physical. So they're manifested in some kind of physical way to communicate something true about them. And I guess that's the most I can say about this at the moment.
Okay. You know, one disadvantage of having me on camera is when I'm tired and I yawn. I'm not bored by you. But
well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah. Other times I am. You really can't tell the difference.
But not right now.
No, but our security company that monitors here at the office called me at 1:30 in the morning because the alarm had gone off.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know about that.
Yeah, see, you don't know the burdens that I go through. No, the for some reason
nobody knew.
Yeah, it was weird. It wasn't even emotion. In the past, we've had like a motion detector go off and malfunction or something. Fortunately, we've never had a break in, but it was the medical alert. So, like, if somebody's actually here, you can push a button if you need medical help. Nobody was here at 1:30 in the morning, though, so it was malfunctioning. But they called me anyways. Hmm. So, anyways, that's why I'm just a little tired. So, next question comes from SVK2 on Twitter, and that name, SVK2, just always makes me think of a serial killer or something. Sounds like a serial killer nickname. Do you think, and just on a TV show I'd seen, there was a serial killer nickname that was similar to that.
I'm sure that person appreciated the reference.
Yeah. Sorry, Steve. I'm sure you're not a serial killer. Do you wonder if any serial killers listen to us?
That has not occurred to me.
Me either. Do you think?
But if they had to listen to any show, this would be a good one. Yeah. I think a serial killer needs what we have to say.
That's really true. Right. Do you think how someone dresses affects their ability to be taken seriously?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is common sense. Just walk down the street and look at people and be observant of your own reactions and feelings about them. Some people look like they can be taken more seriously than others. I mean, I don't mean to be condescending to any group or style of clothing or anything like that, but I think those kinds of things can make a difference with people. And not the ultimate difference, maybe, but I do think they make a difference. This is why we're careful. I'm mindful of the way I dress when I go to public events. Because,
but not here at the office. That's why we don't take you seriously. You have to admit you dress down for us.
I just wear stuff.
We
you know?
At the office. We're very casual here.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. We don't. This is always kind of casual Friday type thing. But it's funny. It never has even crossed my mind to think of how we dress at the office like we dress professional, because we're among ourselves. Other people aren't coming in for the most part. But I do care about when I or any of the other teammates stand before an audience. Mm-hmm. You know. Not that we're trying to impress people, but we don't want to be distracted. We don't want to send the wrong signals. We want to communicate a sense of propriety and confidence and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Good taste.
Do you think clothes should affect the way people are taken seriously?
Well, I think that the clothes, I've not thought about this in particular, so that's why I'm pausing for a moment. I think the clothes often, the way a person presents him or herself says something about the person, all right? Consequently, there is a connection, I think, between the way people are and the way they look. Okay. Now, there are exceptions to this. I mean, look at Einstein was famously sloppy looking. And when I get up in the morning and my hair is kind of bizarre, my kids tell me you look like Einstein. Mm-hmm. You don't think like him, but you look like him. So you can be brilliant and make a brilliant contribution and be a slob.
And you can be a slob and not be brilliant.
Beethoven, I just saw a movie about Beethoven, well, his immortal beloved, but I also read some biographical information as a result of the movie. And Beethoven was a slob and unpleasant. Mm. And yet he was, I mean, extremely unpleasant to a fault, to an extreme fault. But he was a gifted pianist and composer. So it doesn't mean you can't make a contribution, but maybe it's, maybe the idea of loving one's neighbor has something to is it, it can be pressed into service here. I don't want to be too aggressive with it, but
okay.
Anyway, just a thought.
Right. Just a couple minutes on this one, last one from David Trammell. Would you comment on the often said God is love? This comment seems to limit God to just one attribute.
Well, if it does, then then God himself has done so, because that line comes from 1 John 4:7-8. It talks about God being love. I do not think that God intends to limit himself to that attribute. I think that the verse is meant to describe an essential characteristic of God. And so the is, there is an is of essential predication, not an is of identity, like love and God are equal, and there's no difference between the two. It's not a parts whole is, I think. There are different ways to use the word is, and I think in this particular case, it's stating an essential quality of God. But not trying to describe God completely with the term.
But the way many people quote that verse is that that's what they're trying to say, that that's all that God is. I mean, especially this is often quoted, for instance, in objecting to hell or God's wrath and justice.
Right.
And in that case, they are meaning to say that God is love in a sense that it eliminates these other things.
Sure, and that's a mistake, because that's not the only verse in the Bible. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other passages in the Bible, and they tell us something about God and as he is in himself, his nature. And to just use that verse, cherry pick, so to speak, is to create an imbalance.
Okay. Great. That's it for this week. You can send us your questions on Twitter. Use hashtag STRAsk, the name of the podcast. We post new episodes every Monday and Thursday, twice a week. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.